Good morning, everybody. I'm so happy to be here today with Dr. Tara Mitchell, of all people. So let me tell you all a little bit about Dr. Tara Mitchell. She received her PhD in legal psychology from Florida International University in 2005. She started teaching at Lock Haven University in Lock Haven, PA after her graduation. She teaches a variety of courses in psychology and does research on discrimination and interpersonal violence. She also volunteers at her university and in her community to reduce interpersonal violence by empowering people to make the best choices for their own lives. She's been honored to be able to support the work, at least she tells me this, I don't know why, of the Misfit Amish and other Amish and Mennonite survivors who have been speaking out against child abuse among Anabaptists and Anabaptist communities for the past several years, and is excited to talk about the project that I'm kind of leading on child sexual abuse among Amish, Mennonites, Anabaptists, and other religious communities. So with that being said, would you like to say good morning, folks?
Morning, everyone.
Lori says good morning. Good morning, Lori. Well, where do you want to start? So we've been working on this project, right?
Yeah, for over a year, slightly over a year. I think it was just about a year ago when we started trying to develop the questions.
After a particularly fun phone call.
Yeah, there were a few of those. Because it was always interesting that, you know, abuse is something everybody knows is happening, but because nothing has been done systematically, everyone also seems to say, oh, well, that's the exception to the rule. It's not happening that much.
It's an isolated incident. It doesn't really happen. Oh, hey, look. We got Look at the Trees is here. Good morning. And Billy's here. Hi, Billy. Hi, Mousy. How you doing? So one of the things that I've done, so I've been working with Tara for over a year. Tara wrote some wonderful blog posts about the rates of recidivism among sexual offenders for the Misfit Amish. It's listed on our website. You can go find it. If you look in the category of research blog posts, you can find the blog posts that Tara has written. And I'm deeply appreciative. That's actually one of the first things that Tara worked on for me, because I was like, look, like, we don't talk about researchers. Academia doesn't necessarily talk about openly the fact of whether or not child sexual abuse or sexual assault happens inside of Amish communities. So that was kind of my goal, is like, I wanted academia to have something that kind of like talks about that and establishes the fact that this exists, and it's more than just an isolated incident. It's not an isolated incident when people are repetitively reporting that it is something that they too experience. That's not isolated. But in order for us to address that, we have to have something for people. Some people, they don't believe that anecdotal evidence is enough. And I'm beginning to realize that we should probably define like what interpersonal violence is and what anecdotal evidence is. Would you like to be my guest?
So interpersonal violence, it's a really actually kind of broad and vague term, because it refers to any type of aggression or violence between two people. But most of the time when we talk about it, and you'll see it abbreviated sometimes as IPV, mm-hmm. We're usually talking about violence within the context of close relationships. Domestic violence is interpersonal violence. Rape, sexual assault, child abuse are all forms of interpersonal violence. And so the interpersonal violence that I do focus on is rape, sexual assault, sexual harassment, domestic violence, stalking, and human trafficking. Now, anecdotal evidence is actually just a fancy way of saying someone's personal story. We also refer to it in research, we sometimes call it an N of one. So anecdotal evidence is your story. Mm-hmm. But it's just your story, as opposed to what happens in general to people overall.
Right. And then you have to consider too that there's like ethical obligations around researching people. Mm-hmm. Would you like to talk about some of those ethical obligations and like maybe some of the steps we took? We can talk about that.
Okay. Because, you know, one interesting thing for me is, you know, ethical research is a bare minimum. In order for, I'm going to say any self-respecting researcher to conduct a study, it should meet certain bare minimum standards of ethics. And in fact, there are regulations, there are laws governing how researchers interact with participants and conduct their research. So as a psychologist, I follow the APA's guidelines for ethical research. And in order to make sure, like to keep me honest, to make sure that I am following those guidelines, I actually have to run the research by an independent third party called an IRB. And they review my plans to make sure that I am being ethical in how I treat my participants. So when Mary and I decided to collaborate on this project, we had to follow several steps. The first step is actually to receive some training in ethical research.
Correct.
That training is good for 3 years. So every 3 years, I go through the training again, because things do change. Our understanding of ethical treatment changes. So Mary actually had to also go through that training. And then we developed a survey to measure the frequency of child sexual abuse, as well as some other things like how were people taught, if at all, to talk about child sexual abuse. Mary and I worked with 3 other consultants to make sure that the wording of the survey was appropriate for Amish, Mennonite, and other conservative religious groups. Once we finished the survey, we had to submit it to the IRB.
Can I interject just for a minute? Let me explain to you why we worked with other individuals in consultation with to develop mm-hmm. the questions appropriately. Because there is a language barrier, even amongst plain and conservative religious groups who may grow up speaking English, they may still use English in a different way than, say, mainstream Americans use English. And so it was important to consult with people who had different varieties of experiences in order to ensure that the wording reaches the most people possible inside of those communities who participate, so that they can understand what we're actually asking. And I'd give to you, for an example, one of the questions that we ask our participants was, were you born in the church? And for many, that may not make sense. But for people that participated, the majority of them, that made sense.
And I do think, too, like, we had 2 people who had experience in Amish communities and two people who had experience with Mennonite communities. And ideas were run past people in terms of wording beyond just our consultants. We did not want it to be, well, one Amish person said this, and one Mennonite person said this, and one English person said this. And so it was important for us to develop the survey, and it's actually a very good quality of research design and survey design to do what is necessary to make sure that your intended audience will understand the questions the way you intend. And one thing that I can see Billy's comment on the screen. We spent hours discussing kind of the nuance of some of these questions. And then when we submitted our proposal to the IRB, we submitted a copy of our research questions. And we had to explain why we chose to word questions a certain way to the IRB as well. Now, so those questions.
And then we had to make sure, because that's where like bridging the gap is so important when you talk about language barriers, is because like even though the IRB may not have received those questions in the way that was it was intended, for example, like Billy says, I'd never would have thought that meant you physically were born there. Right. Because you have a plain background, right? But if you say that to a person who comes from mainstream society in America, they're going to think you mean, were you born in the church, right? Like literally physically born in the church. And
And
so.
I can say yes, they do, because I asked Mary and the research consultants. I was like, "Are you sure, like, that's the best way to word that?" Because we're not born in the church, and actually not.
Okay. I'm gonna tell y'all what I told Tara, okay? So, in my Amish communities, we had church in our homes, okay? So, if we had church in our homes and I was born at home, doesn't that mean that I was born in a church? Was I born in a church? I just have to ask that question. But that's like sidetracking. Back to.
But I think it is in some ways important for people to also know that ethical research, and again, I think of this as the bare minimum. It's not, let me wave my magic wand and it's created. There's a lot of give and take, especially if it's a collaborative process, and if it's a collaborative process with a group that you are not part of.
Right,
You know,
which
so
is
as an English person, even from a conservative religious mainstream religion, it's important that the researcher listen to people from the communities they're trying to study, and that means it's going to take a little while.
right, which is why. We spent from what was it like from August to December before we defended our study.
Yeah, I think it was. I think we started in August. We submitted to the IRB like in late November, and then they met with us in December. You know, and the whole purpose of the IRB is really to make sure that you have met the ethical standards.
The bare minimum.
And have you created a study that is going to provide knowledge while not harming your participants. And part of that is, did you design something that's going to be able to answer questions? And so we did spend a lot of time with the IRB discussing I kind of think of it as three things. They wanted to make sure that the survey was actually like well worded.
Right.
And that did cause some conversations.
I think that was a,
you know,
I think that was the biggest drawback for the IRB is the way that it was worded. And I'm going to be quite frank with you about that is like, for me, I found that that was the biggest conversations that we had with the IRB is having to explain cultural language versus mainstream language.
Yeah. Because, you know,
and I'm not upset about it. If you don't know, you don't know, right? Like, no. People think that when I say things that I'm saying it because I'm judging them because they don't know. That's not the truth. The truth is I'm telling you things because you don't know. And yeah. Just because it's facts and there's like not a glossed over version of it doesn't mean that I think you're a bad person.
And I think that, you know, the people on the IRB learned some things.
Yeah, I would agree.
And they took no offense from it.
Right.
So, to me, the other part of it that was very important to them, you know, we are researching child sexual abuse. And that is a very sensitive topic. And so they wanted to ensure that we were conducting the study in such a way that the confidentiality of our participants is protected. Like at no point should anyone be able to guess who our participants are by the way we talk about this research.
Right. And I think it's not just the confidentiality. I also think it's the safety comes into play when you start talking about marginalized communities, because they ask a few questions that led me to believe the IRB really cared about the safety of the participants, the confidentiality. How are we going to do like the least amount of harm possible? Mm-hmm. Because let's be real. When you're researching child sexual assault, that can be a really distressing and intense topic that can bring up really intense emotions for people that do participate.
Yep.
So what are we doing to mitigate that risk? How are we going to protect the people that do answer the survey? How do we do that? How do we manage that? And I will tell you that right now, like all of the participants in our research, IRB is the Institutional Review Board, Valerie. All of the participants had the option to literally, if they said they were over the age of 18, they could literally skip through all the rest of the questions without answering a single question if it was distressing to them. That's one of the ways that we allow people to maintain their own self and not be forced to feel like they have to participate. And the other thing is that people were also able to answer like 3 questions out of 20, and that's okay too.
None of the questions were required beyond, are you over the age of 18? If they did not answer that question, they could not go any further in the study. And we did that very deliberately, and the IRB required that because asking children, 17 or 7 doesn't matter. Anyone under the age of 18, asking a child about child sexual abuse that they have experienced, that's not okay. Mm-hmm. To me in research. And there are studies that try to look at child sexual abuse from the perspective of the child. And the protocols for that are through the roof. And they should be. We were not going to risk having a child participate in this study on child sexual abuse.
Right.
So that was our one required question.
And that's why. And then the other thing is on the at the end of the page, we had resources listed. Mm-hmm. We did not collect, I will tell you, we did not collect the single person's IP address, because again, that can raise confidentiality and safety issues for participants in research about child sexual abuse.
And I think one of the things that is interesting, you know, and we've talked a lot about the IRB as being the bare minimum. And one thing that seems clear, and I've only been working with Amish, Mennonite, and other Anabaptist groups for a little over a year, the safety concerns for talking about child sexual abuse or sexual assault within plain communities seems to be greater. There is greater risk for people who are speaking out about child sexual abuse in plain communities than in English communities. And so for us, when we designed this study, that was at the forefront in everything we did.
Right. And the other thing is, one of the things that I want each of you to know is that we were approved to do a paper data collection a very specific way with, again, ensuring that everything is anonymous. We did not actually collect any responses that way because things changed prior to that, and we had to make a decision based on whether the participants, if they did participate, would their confidentiality be upheld? Would their safety be at risk? And the answer was their safety could be at risk. Their confidentiality could be at risk. So we could not collect the data at that time in that manner.
And so once we got permission.
Right.
From the IRB, we set up the study, and we, as Mary was explaining, we were going to do it both online, and we were going to have a paper copy for in person. The online version, at least for me, far exceeded my expectations.
I was shocked.
You know, we had 270, I think it was two.
Hold on. Let me go look. I'll tell you exactly. You're saying we had 280 Anabaptists born.
Okay. And then 30 who joined at some point in their lives.
Right.
And then of that, we have 172 current. So
correct.
We had, I would have been happy probably with far less than that. You know, we had almost 300 people who had been, actually.
No, 80 plus 30. So if we had 380 born in and 30 joined in, that's like, 280.
Yeah, so
that's like 310 participants with Anabaptist church experiences.
And then out of that, 172 still were.
Right.
So that was actually exceeded my expectations. And one benefit to the online, we don't know who they are. This went out via electronic means, like emails, it was posted on website, went out via social media. And whoever wanted to answer the questions could.
And let me also make something very clear. The statement that went out on social media and via email lists, that statement was also approved by the IRB.
Yep.
Just so y'all realize that, like, it had to be worded in a specific way so that it's not, so that it's ethical, so that it's not like demanding that people must participate or, you know, giving off other, there's certain information that had to be put in that, and we did that.
And one of the things that's important is, you know, to make sure that you are careful of what we call multiple roles. You know, so if we had sent things out in such a way that people thought that in order to work with Mary, they had to participate. That is a form of coercion. It's a form of pressure that you kind of think, well, if I want to work with Mary, I got to fill this up. So one thing that the IRB really worked with us on and wanted to make sure we did was send out information in such a way that that pressure was not there.
Right.
And again, because of how we sent it out, we don't know who participated. I don't want to know who participated.
I don't. No. And the other thing I want to assure you guys of, like, truthfully, like, I literally, you do not have to tell me that you participated. It does not matter to me unless, like, if you feel like you would gain something from telling me things, okay, that's fine. But in the same token, like, I do not need to know. It is irrelevant to me whether or not you participated and whether I will be able to work with you or not.
And that's, you know, like, for me as a professor, like, that often comes to, if I tell my students about a study, do they think they have to participate so they'll get an A in my class? One, no. And two, I actually, like, I don't want people to think that that is information that they have to share in that way. And so that was something, again, with the online research, we did that in part to reduce that pressure. And like I said, we had hoped to add a print version because we do understand that, particularly among conservative playing communities, the ability to get access to that online survey was reduced. You know, as we were told, I mean, there are Anabaptist communities, even conservative ones, where they have access to cell phones and they can get online.
Right. But as we discovered, that is true.
It's
but
less common.
Yes.
But the downside to the print version, and again, we just did not feel comfortable with this possibility, is that a person could be seen taking the print copy of the survey and in some communities, even being within like 5 feet of a copy of the survey apparently was cause for concern. And so it would not have been safe.
Right.
And so that's why it was online only in the end, is the safety of participants. And their anonymity.
Right.
So May 1st was the day that we closed data collection.
Correct.
And since May 1st, we've been going through the data, and some of it is quantitative. It's numerically based. And so we've been running some statistics on that. And some of it is qualitative. It is information provided in the participants' own words. And for example, we asked participants if they had been taught child sexual abuse was a sin, what was it called? Mm-hmm. Now that takes longer to go through than our numbers do.
Right.
And I think Mary is showing some of those numbers.
So this is the numbers too, where you taught child sexual abuse is a sin. And I want to point this out, is that, so out of the people that answered this question, so there were 326 people that answered this question, 126 said no. 200 said yes. That means 61% said that yes, they were taught it was a sin. And the interesting thing is for were you taught that a child sexual assault is a crime or child sexual abuse is a crime? 184 people said no. And if you look at those numbers, so 184 out of 319 people said no. And 135 people said yes. But those numbers are almost reversed. If you were taught that it was a sin, that makes me ask the question, is if you were taught that it was a sin, were you also taught that it is a crime?
And one of the things that
How did those two questions relate to each other, those two answers relate to each other, and how does that affect people's abilities to access resources after they've experienced a crime?
and one reason the this part of the process that we're in, the analysis part, can be a little slow. One, the qualitative piece takes some time, but two, we had certain questions we wanted answered. Question one, does it happen at all? No. I think to most people who have been doing this work, that is what I was, when I was growing up, it was called a no-brainer. Like, of course this happens. But we wanted to address that statistically. But some things, as we look at this data, it raises new questions. So we can look to see how many of the people who were taught it was a sin were also taught it was a crime. That is possible with this data, and that's something that we are seeing might be needed based on the data that we've looked at so far. Because I think, the key for me is it's not that it's wrong that they were taught child sexual abuse is a sin.
Right.
Religious
Like,
communities, that is
I
not
mean,
wrong.
it's completely fine to teach people that child sexual assault or child sexual abuse is a sin. But the
But
other question is are you also teaching in your religions that it's a crime also? Because it is a crime. That's a fact. That's not me saying that. That's the law.
and that's so when we look at ways in which child sexual abuse might be talked about differently in religious communities. Well, one, if they're not taught it's a sin or a crime, is it being talked about it at all?
Right.
But two, if they are only taught that it is a sin, does that mean they are not also aware that every religious leader in the state of Pennsylvania is a mandated reporter?
Every
They know
teacher,
that.
every teacher, every childcare provider.
And so,
And let me make something perfectly clear, okay? I know that there's people that do not realize or understand that even if you have not had mandated reporter training, if you hold a position that puts you in charge for the welfare of children, you are a mandated reporter in most states.
And that's, ignorance is not bliss. You cannot say, oh, I didn't know I was supposed to report and expect there to be no consequences for you. It is against the law for mandated reporters not to report. And that is not something where you can say, I didn't know. And I believe a previous guest was talking about mandated reporter training that they had gone through.
Yes.
If if your mandated reporter training does not use the word rape or sexual abuse or sexual assault, because those words are not used
in your culture,
you're still held to the standard of mandated reporting. So it's important to know the terms that people are using. And this is not about bashing Anabaptists. This is not about bashing conservative religions. This is about understanding the way in which these issues play out.
And not only understanding the issue, the way these issues play out, but also addressing it and giving accurate information that is up to date as far as like what the law is, as far as like what, you know, people are required to do nowadays. I will say this is like our hypothesis was, is that we actually needed to, because we looked for research on child sexual assault amongst Amish and Anabaptists. We looked for research on that and we did not find anything for Amish, right? So because we did not find anything for Amish, that's part of why we decided that we were going to do this. Mm-hmm. Regardless, I would like to let all of you know that even though we collected so much information and we had so many participants, because of the fact that the Misfit Amish purely exists as a way to bridge cultural gaps between Amish and the Western society, and that was our social media pages were used to collect information, and then there's also the Plain People's podcast, I believe A Better Way sent it out as mm-hmm. well. And those two organizations also exist to serve Amish and Anabaptist communities in various ways. Because of the fact that this is the sole purpose of the organizations that put it out there publicly, I'm not going to say that this data is like, you know, set in stone, as in what are the rates of child sexual assault. And I want everybody who's listening to understand this very clearly, is that yes, we're seeing that 47% of the people who were willing to answer this question of were you sexually abused as a child, 47% said yes, 9% said unsure, and then 43% said no. The fact of the matter is because of the way that this data was collected and because of the work that these organizations do, this data could be skewed either to be too high of a rate or to be too low of a rate. We don't know. We do not know.
And that's actually, and it's not just the organizations involved. It's no one was forced
right
to participate. And so one question we were asked, you know, it seems like people who are interested in child sexual abuse would be more likely to volunteer mm-hmm. to participate. And that is true. And we went through organizations related to child sexual abuse, but
right. But there's also the fact that we, when we described how like we had received approval for paper surveys, but we did not end up collecting data that way because of safety concerns. Like that's an ethical act of like, you know, making sure that people who are able to and volunteer to participate, they're protected. Mm-hmm. But it still also could have skewed the data again. Mm-hmm.
So it is important, you know, we're saying 1 in 2, 50% if you round up, 48% if you don't. That doesn't mean that half of Anabaptist children are sexually abused.
It doesn't.
But it does clearly show that it's more than one.
It does also show that it's not an isolated incident, and people need to stop talking about child sexual assault in Amish and Anabaptist circles as being isolated incidents. They are people, just like the rest of society. They're a group of people. Humanize them enough to allow some of them to be people that are not fitting of the Anabaptist narrative that you have worshipped for so long. Humanize them. And I want to point out, too, that 80% of the participants were female. Does that suggest that females have a more vested interest in child sexual abuse because it's affecting them at a disproportionate rate?
And that's very possible. It's... you know, also possible. So one of the things that we asked is how people might have been impacted by child sexual abuse, even if it didn't happen to them. Mm-hmm. You know, because part of what child sexual abuse does is it affects the community.
It does.
It affects more than just the child. It affects people who know that the child has been abused and see nothing happening. You know, it affects the way in which the child interacts with others. And so one of the interesting things about this is from a community aspect, how are our communities being affected by that? And this goes back to, is it disproportionately affecting females in particularly conservative communities where females may be the driver of the home, the driver of that community sense, not the leaders per se, but the women building the homes.
Right.
There are so many questions about that.
I did want to also point something else out. Is there is a book out there in which a psychologist legitimately says it is safe to assume that there's no gay Amish people. I'm not naming names. I'm not naming the book. But I just want to point out this.
Please let me laugh at this mysterious person out there, because that's a lie.
That's a lie. That's a lie. So we did not collect information on people's sexual orientation, but we did collect information on gender. So all I got to say is that, you know, if you are LGBTQ and you happen to be Amish or Anabaptist of any form, shape, or way, just know that you are not alone. You are not alone. There is evidence that we exist.
Well, and you know, and again, as the English outsider on this, but grew up in Florida, which, well, some people say is not the South, but is the South, in a conservative background. If you try and argue that LGBTQ people don't exist because you will be kicked out of your home if people find out you have a same-sex attraction, you're not saying they don't exist. You're saying people will kill you if you act on your desires. Does that make sense? Like, sorry, you know, telling people that they don't exist simply because they will die if they act on same-sex attraction, that's not...
Okay.
That's not real.
That's not real. And I want to point out this too, like I know some of you already know this, is that to be Amish is not just a religion. To be Amish is also to have specific genetic disorders or, you know, be predisposed to specific genetic disorders, and it's a genetic thing. Like if you take DNA tests, like we have like Pennsylvania Dutch, they call it that. You can't just take the Pennsylvania Dutch or the Amish genetics out of your genetic makeup just because you no longer comply with the church rules. So I'd like to ask you, when do you take the Amish genetics out of me? Because that day, when you take the Amish genetics out of me, I'll stop saying I'm Amish. Okay? You're welcome.
And for some, it might seem like we've gotten off track of our research. But I really don't think we have, because that was a huge issue when we designed this. You know, and when we look at research on the Amish, there's almost an exclusive, or at least there seems to be an exclusive reliance on people who are currently in the church.
You read my mind. That's exactly where I was going with that. So that is the justification behind allowing people who are not currently conforming to the church rules to participate, is because they are valid. They are valid, and they will never escape the consequences and implications of being Anabaptist born or being Anabaptist joined. That will affect them for the rest of their lives. And it will affect many of them for multiple generations. So why are we silencing the people who don't comply with church rules in academia? What vested interest does academia have to do that? And this is going down the rabbit hole, and we don't need to talk about that.
Well, as a teaser, this is not a finished analysis yet, but I will also say that our research, well, I'm going to say it even though, again, it's not posted yet. Our research is suggesting that there is a difference in child sexual abuse rates when you look at people who have remained part of an Anabaptist church and people who have left an Anabaptist church. And so, from my perspective, again, as an outsider, if you are deliberately or not, don't want to assign motives to anyone, but if you are deliberately or not refusing to include the voices of former members of Anabaptist communities, non-compliant Amish, people who joined and then left, you're not getting the whole story of what happened while those people were part of an Anabaptist church.
You're only telling a flawed perspective as a researcher. You're only telling a flawed perspective because you're telling the perspective of the people who have obviously remained. And typically, when you only tell the perspective from bishops and from, you know, wealthy business owners in the community, you're telling the perspective of the most privileged in the Amish communities. What do they have to benefit from telling the whole story?
And I think, you know, it's the closest comparison to particularly like conservative plain people is Jewish people. You know, there are Jews religiously, and then there are people with an ancestral heritage of Judaism being Jewish. You know, we don't look at someone who is non-compliant, I'm learning that word from Mary, with the Jewish faith and say, well, you're not Jewish anymore based on your heritage. we have to learn when we're thinking about working with playing communities, we have to realize that there is an Amish heritage and there is an Amish church. There is a Mennonite heritage and there is a Mennonite church. And just because you leave the church doesn't mean you leave the heritage. You can't leave the heritage behind. So it is doing Anabaptists and it is doing the research community and it's doing society a disservice to not include non-compliant plain people.
Yep. So that's why we decided that we were going to include people from all walks and ways. Like if they are non-compliant, okay, that's fine. You're still eligible to participate. It doesn't matter. Even if you were like a second generation, like your grandparents left the Amish community, you were still eligible to participate.
Oh yeah.
Like that's like a thing of like being able to participate wasn't based on whether or not you were currently in the church or you were currently being a good church member. But yeah, so that's like a very important detail and distinction, is ensuring that we hear the voices of all and especially the most marginalized people. In my opinion, that was one of the most important things, is making sure we capture those who were joined in. And for those who would typically say that the joined in people don't get to talk about our culture and heritage, yes, they do. Their voices are just as valid and they have very important contributions to the conversation. Because for them, even though their experiences are a little bit different than, say, those of somebody who was born in, they have other experiences that allow them to see these experiences with a unique lens that can help us bridge the gap between the two cultures in a better way to make meaningful change. So yeah, I think we should make our clothing thoughts, because we're not getting to the other blog post and going through all of that today. What do you think?
Yeah.
I mean, unless we want a 2-hour, 3-hour live recording, and I don't think I'm up for that.
That I did not plan for 2 to 3 hours today.
I didn't either.
But I actually, so the table that you kind of stopped on, did CSA impact you? I actually think for me, that table is a perfect closing thought. You know, there are a lot of people who minimize, and I'm going to call them family crimes, domestic violence, child abuse. It should all stay in the family. It's a family problem. It's not. Even one child being harmed deliberately by the people who are supposed to care for that child is a problem. But two, 48% of our participants were sexually abused. That's a high number. 70% were affected. And a further 12% were unsure. In some circles, they say that if someone says unsure, they really mean yes. They're just afraid to say yes. I don't know if that's true of this data, but if it is, 80% of our participants were affected by child sexual abuse. It is not a family problem.
it's not even a church, just a church problem. If you use that same language around, because there's church communities that use that same language of like, we keep it in the church, we don't go to the law. I don't know. No, you don't wait until it happens three times or until the same offender commits a crime three times before you report it to the law. If he is harming, if somebody is harming a child, that is like the first time you report it. The first time it happens. You are not the law. You are not God. You don't get to decide whether or not this survivor deserves access to resources or whether or not there's any form of like accountability for the crimes committed. You don't get to do that. You're just a human being like the rest of us.
And it's the sooner you step in, because again, children should not be harmed. And I see Lori's comment, and that is also true. Not because we have this idea of what abuse must be. Mm-hmm. We don't recognize everything that is abuse as abuse. And the sooner someone intervenes to support the child.
Yep, that one.
Not to silence the child, but to support the child, they are not only supporting the child, they are showing their community the best way to be healthy, the best way to have healthy relationships. It's not abuse. It's stopping abuse. And as a psychologist, I'm not a clinician, but as a psychologist that looks at the way society functions and the way relationships work, helping one child not only is the right thing to do, but helping one child helps 80% of people out there who are also going to benefit from that child being supported in the appropriate way.
Yep. Not only that, but helping that child also makes long-term outcomes much better. Mm-hmm. It actually has been shown, studies exist that show that when children they report, or when they receive interventions that lead to safety for them, that there's a reduction in the amount of children that go on to develop chronic PTSD. So think about that. But on that note, thank you all for joining us. I'm grateful to have had this time. Thank you, Tara, for having this conversation. I guess we're going to pick up later.
And so, yeah, maybe we can, another time, we can actually talk about the statistical findings rather than just the percentages.
Yeah, I think, yeah, we're going to keep working on the data analysis, and we'll do another live when we get to that part, when we get that ready and all of that. How's that sound for everybody? Sound good to you?
Thanks. Yeah. And thank you, everyone. I know I've only seen a couple comments come up, but thank you, everyone, for joining us on a Saturday morning to talk about research and research ethics.
Yeah.
And I do hope everyone can join us when we start talking about the statistical findings.
Yes. I would greatly appreciate that. And I'm just glad that I get to have these conversations in my lifetime. I'm really, really grateful for that.
I'm sorry that it had to take your lifetime.
I mean, yeah, we do what we have to do.
Yep.
But yeah, we're going to keep working. I hope all of you know that you are worthy of a healthy, happy, and whole life, and you deserve joy in your life, and that you keep living the best life in a way that makes sense for you. Have a beautiful Saturday. Aww.